Again, I managed to get some job that kept me off the plotting table in the little office in the higher gallery. I can't remember what it was I did, but something I didn't have to plot. We were having a fairly quiet time, I think, then, because we were in the middle of England, and I can remember people sitting around knitting and making felt toys, and one of the controllers used to do lovely tapestry work, like that little table there. And it really was rather awful, because, you see, it was back to huts, 30 people in a hut, the ablutions were miles away, it was winter. We had to go, the coke heap was a long way from our hut, and we had to go with a great big, these great bars, you know, with a handle each end, fill it up with coke and stagger back. But we had these stoves each end of the hut, you see, to try and keep the place warm. And during that time, I must have got some leave, and Rafe asked me down to Clevedon for the weekend. And I found later my mother-in-law's diary where she put, Rafe bought a waft girl down for the weekend. Amazing that such a refined girl should have to live in a hut with 30 other women. That was the only comment about it. Anyway, I can remember there was one night we were standing in a queue waiting for the last watch to move out while we took their place. And we had a very nice man flight sergeant who always called us Miss and our surnames instead of just the surnames. Incidentally, I had, of course, had a number in those days, and that's, I bet you girls who were in the forces, you always remember your service number, even if you forget everybody's telephone number. 2005813 is my number. But this man called us Miss Burton and Miss So-and-so. And he was chatting away, and he said, you know, you girls have got an awful lot of power, much more power than the men. He said, why don't you get your fathers to write to the Minister of Air, Sergeant Ball Sinclair, and complain about these 3 weeks of night watches? Because he said they might change them. The men daren't complain. They could be posted to the Outer Orkneys or something, Glass House or somewhere, but the girls, they couldn't do a lot too. And, of course, we were often ill, you know. By the time you came off duty, it was still dark, and then you went to bed and you woke up again, it was still dark. You know, you never saw daylight in the winter. So I thought, well, I'm going to get my father to write and about the others. So I got on to Goody, Father Secretary, this good fellow, who worked for him before he married in 1914. This is not 1940. So I've known him since I was born. And I explained what I want done. I said, do it on Harley Street writing paper, you know, put all the letters on, sort of pull rank, as we call it, don't we? To Sir Archibald Sinclair. And I thought, don't expect anything to happen. I forgot it after a bit, and after about 2 weeks I was on duty, and the warrant officer came into my little cubby hole, and he said, Burton, have you got any compassionate grounds for being posted near London? So I had a quick think, and I said, oh, yes, sir. Because a warrant officer was the next thing to an officer. See, I said, my father is very elderly. Didn't say he was still consulting. He was in the 70s. And I said, he's not terribly well, and it would be lovely if I could be near him. He said, you will be posted to Fighter Command tomorrow morning to the movement liaison section. Quick as a flash. He didn't want me to see any other girls to discuss what had happened. I was in trouble there. He said, you can have 2 days leave at home and then report to Stanmore, to Bendy Pryor, to the Fighter Command section. So, of course, that was marvellous. They just wanted to get rid of me. I never did find out that they were quickly changing watches or anything. Anyway, Stanmore couldn't have been better for me. It was a bus down to the underground. The underground Bakerloo line was on the line where my family lived. I could be home within an hour. I wasn't in the main fighter command operations room. The movement liaison section was in what they called the filter room, which was about a mile away from the operations room. Again, we had a small stately home. The operations room itself was in the garden, slightly below the ground, and we were in huts, but we had a mess in the main house. And, of course, it was marvellous watches, very thoughtful and imaginatively worked out. Because they were, you kept getting a little sort of 24 hours off or 48 hours off, and you know, they were nicely balanced. And of course, it was wonderful to be able to get to and from home so easily. And of course, the work of the liaison section was just up my street. What we had to do was, we about five of us on the watch with an officer, and we had the telephone, and we had to take on a piece of paper the movement of every aircraft that moved throughout the country. You see, this is really the way they could identify aircraft. If they knew where aircraft were taking off from, at what time, and when they were arriving back, where they were crossing the coast, if they were going to France, and coming back, and all that sort of thing, all helped them to identify what was moving on the plotting paper. Of course, I had to, one of the things we had to learn was a 24-hour clock, which, of course, was always difficult at the beginning. If you remember, ages ago, the idea of 1,800 hours and 60 clocks seemed quite illogical. Also, we had to learn to say the alphabet, A for Abel, B for Baker, C for Charlie. It's all changed now, the American one. And what was quite amusing with some of these movements we were given was from the American stations, because they didn't know how to pronounce the names of the towns in England, you know, and you had this American voice in crossing over Reading, Salisbury, crossing the coasts at Folkestone. when they got to the French part of them crossing the coast in France, that was completely unintelligible. And we did have an American officer with us for a time. My goodness, their uniforms were smart. We used to work out a sort of mix and match that he had. You know, he had a lovely cream battle dress, and he had a dark green battle dress, and he had a dark green tunic, and he would wear the dark green tunic with a cream trousers and cape. That's beautiful material, of course. And, it was interesting and quite exciting work. We were, as I said about the official secrets, we didn't query what all these movements were about or discuss it among ourselves. We had our own lives to lead, of course. And some of the movements I found out afterwards, they had code names and what they meant. Pathfinders itself is explanatory because they were very often going ahead, you see, before the actual bombing raid. Then there was Window, which we heard about afterwards, which was when they dropped the strips of foil to try and baffle the radar stations. And then you would have a movement of two aircraft called carpetbaggers, and they would go out and come back. And that was dropping people in France to join the resistance, we discovered later. Anyway, as time went on, of course, the moment came of June the 5th, 1944, and I was on duty from 5 to 9 that evening. And a movement has started to come through. Movements like 500 aircraft carrying drivers. Mm-hmm. And we were terribly busy during that time. And then all this was going to happen during the night. And we got the movements, obviously, several hours before they took off. I remember our officer speaking to us before we came off duty. And she said, you must not discuss this among yourselves when you leave this room, the operations room. And you mustn't even discuss it among your fellow people in your hut, which of course we did, but by the time I went on duty the next morning at 8 o'clock, the invasion was happening. And of course, all very exciting, but all was not over, as you know. Just over a week later, we were warned about this, the flying bombs started to come, and before they arrived, we were told, while we were on duty, that there would be a call sign for them, and the plotter on the table, when she heard on her headset the words diver, diver, diver from one of the radar stations, she would shout that out, because that would help the controllers. It could terribly difficult to plot. They came at such speed, and of course London was the main target, and they went on. Of course the V2s came afterwards. My mother was terribly frightened with the V1s because they would stop, and then you'd start, you know, and they'd glide on. And the first one, my friend looked up a bit of information for me, because she said, got me the dates for this, and she said the first one of all came down. The first V1 was on the 13th of June in 1944, and it caused 6 fatalities and 30 people injured, and happened at Bethnal Green. And then it went on till about September, I think, on and off. My mother was terribly frightened by them, and she decided to take refuge in the country. And where do you think she came? She removed my father and my younger brother and her maid to Nailsea House. Wasn't that funny? I never knew I was going to live here then. And she had some friends who lived there. And, of course, I think what with the flying bombs and one thing or another, she decided that she rather made the decisions in our family, because she was 20 years younger than my father, and that they were going to give up a big house in London and go and live outside in the so-called country. They decided to go to Walton-on-Thames. It was a bit of a shock, because it had been our family home for many years. My brother by then was married. Both my sisters were away from London working, and my younger brother was working in London, because I was at Stanmore, and it was an 11-bedroom house, and no question of ever having servants again. So Mother said, you can all have your bedroom furniture, but you'll have to put it in the store, because we can't take it with us to where we're going. There'll be 5 bedrooms where we're going, so we could always go and stay. But the family home would be the same. So I thought, well, if I could put furniture in the store, supposing I get an unfurnished room and put the furniture in it, you know, near where my home was, and be a place for me to retreat in. So I went around and looked in the post office window where they put those cards up, and I saw a little card that said, unfurnished room to let 14 shillings a week. And so I went round to see it. It was really quite suitable, not quite as big as my bedroom, but it was on the first floor near Swiss Cottage tube station. So that was what I did. In due course, I moved all my things in there. And I also discovered that you could get a living out allowance and also a ration book. So I thought to myself, I've still got to keep a bed in camp, because some of our watches, we came off duty at 2 o'clock in the morning, and some of them you went on duty at 2 o'clock in the morning, so I had to have a bed. I thought to myself, there's such a big offices, because there was a whole of Bentley Priory, as well as the filter room and our part, and I thought, if the living out office never gets together with the living in one, they'll never catch me out, put it that way. And they never did, because when I was finally demobbed, I got given a pair of sheets. Do you remember, Rosie?
Yes.
I mean, they were practically made of canvas, but it was to be our sort of diary. And so it went on. And of course, it was all busy, as you can imagine, after the invasion, and the war continuing for another year, wasn't it, until May. And then, of course, the war in Europe ended. And, of course, there was a case of what were you going to do with all these service women? You couldn't demob them all at once, because the labour market would have been absolutely overburdened with finding jobs for them. So they had to be gradually demobbed, you know, a few at a time. Of course, there wasn't a great deal of work to do at Stanmore. There was a very nasty moment when I think it got to about August, and I suddenly called in and told them I was to be posted to Gloucester as clerk ordinary duties, which absolutely appalled me, because, you see, I met Jerry on his repatriation leave, and by then he was with his ship up in Liverpool, and they would get to London, that sort of thing. No way was I going to go out back to Innsbruck and Gloucester and clean evolution. So I went to see the CO, and I said, you know, ma'am, I'm here on a compassionate posting. And she said, oh, never mind, your papers will follow you there. I know how long they would take, and then you can be sent back. And I said, well, I'm not going. I physically am not going. So she shrugged her shoulders and said, oh, well, do what you like then. So I went on, going on watch and that sort of thing, and I thought, am I going to be one of these forgotten women? My papers will have gone to Gloucester. And I'm sitting at Stanmore, and my demobilisation will never come through, you see. And once, when I was on one of my many compassionate leaves, and I kept asking for when Jerry got to leave, I got back, and it was November 1945, and my demobilisation had come through. And I had to go to Birmingham to be demobbed. And I remember we had to stay overnight to do any paperwork, and that sort of thing. We got our gratuity. We weren't in suits like the men. And, of course, we kept our uniforms and all our underclothes, shirts and all that sort of thing. And I remember on the journey back, I sat in a first-class carriage and I paid the extra, because, you see, in the ranks, you're not supposed to sit in a first-class carriage. And I was not in the Air Force anymore, though I was in uniform. I never even got offered a commission. I never got beyond being a leading aircraft woman, which didn't worry me too much. Somebody said to me once, didn't you tell them that your father was a Harley Street surgeon and you'd been to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art? And I said, good heavens, no. Whatever's that got to do with it? And I told them I'd been very busy running a wholesale dress shop. They thought it was some old little back street place, you know, in the East End. But anyway, it suited me. I don't feel that my 4 years in the RAF helped win the war. But never mind, it was an experience.
Yes.
And I'm sure other people have got things to add to what I've said.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a photograph, by the way, that was taken at Morecambe. I'm the taller one.
I was at Morecambe. Well, you're right.
Yeah.
It was horrid.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
I don't think I'm